Cleaning Up is brought to you by the Liebreich Foundation and the Gilardini Foundation. Hello, my name is Michael Liebreich, and this is Cleaning Up. My guest today is Greg Jackson, CEO and founder of Octopus Energy. Octopus is a challenger utility in the UK, which has grown over the 5 years since its founding to serve just under 2 million households, growing at about 30,000 per week. Octopus, under Greg's leadership, has also started to expand overseas and to offer its unique technology platform to other utilities. It's a fascinating story. Please welcome Greg Jackson to Cleaning Up. So Greg, welcome to Cleaning Up.
Well, thank you, Michael, and welcome to Octopus's lockdown office, where I am very, very lonely.
Now, I hope, despite the fact that it's a place of work, I hope that you've got yourself a brew there, because I certainly have. It's evening here and I'm stuck in Switzerland again. So cheers.
Yeah, well, I've got a delicious Beavertown neck oil from the Octopus fridge. Ordinarily, we get the whole team together on a Friday night. We have fridges full of alcohol and non-alcoholic beverages to bring our team together. And, you know, through lockdown, we're not getting through it very quickly.
Well, so I think, you know what, we'll come back, I suspect, to talk about your leadership style and the culture that you're building at Octopus, because it's very particular, I already know. Let's start with, just give us an update of where are you with Octopus. Just so you know, our audience is, they're all super engaged. They're all very smart, but they don't know everything about the energy system. They certainly don't know the UK utility landscape, and they may not know Octopus, strange though that may sound.
So Octopus was founded about 5 years ago by a group of people led by me who came from a technology background. We'd built technology platforms in a whole bunch of industries, working for third parties, you know, from SAP to retailers, loads of companies. And I think when we sold that business, we looked around to say which sector in the world has not yet been disrupted by technology. Energy was this, you know, kind of sector which served, you know, pretty much every customer in every advanced economy, but was largely undisrupted, I guess, because of regulation. Not only that, but, you know, energy is at the forefront of the fight against climate change. So there was this opportunity to use technology, we thought, to drive down costs, improve service, and tackle climate change. Where we are today is we built a platform, Kraken, which is designed to be a global platform for running energy companies. We've got 2 million household customers here in the UK, to be precise, 1.953 million. It'll be 2 million by the end of next week. In addition, we've got businesses in the Octopus brand in Germany and in the USA. And we've also licensed our platform to Origin Energy in Australia, to Hanwha, who run a retail business in Australia. We've licensed it to E.ON and Good Energy here in the UK. We've formed a joint venture with Tokyo Gas to launch Octopus Energy Japan. We've got an office in New Zealand about to launch there. So it's pretty exciting, Michael.
That's extraordinary. Now, let's just back up a little bit and put the UK piece, first of all, into context. So you've got 1.93, you said, million users. And at the end of next week, you'll have 2 million. So you are growing at 70,000 a week?
Not quite, yeah, it's 1.953.
1.953, oh, sorry. So you're growing at 50,000 a week, does that mean?
Yeah, it's 29,000 last week.
So. Okay, 29,000, okay. You're forgiven for rounding up. These are big numbers. And that puts you where in, because we've got the big six and then you've got the various challengers. Where does that put you?
Yeah, I think it makes us number five in the UK market now. So when we started, people said, how are you going to kind of tackle the big six? And well, I think we now are one. That's the customers we're serving directly here in the UK. Yeah. Through licensing,
you say, to two other groups. So in total, how many households would be in some way being touched by your platform, Kraken?
Yeah, so total number of households at the moment is probably around sort of between 3 and 3.5 million households in the UK. And then the total number of licenses globally is now 17 million. Sooner or later, about 80% of our customers are going to be served by people licensing the platform rather than us. We've got an ambition to get to 100 million customers by 2027 on the platform. And you know, I'm beginning to worry that might not be ambitious enough.
It doesn't sound very ambitious when you look at all those countries you're going to be in.
Yeah, no, you're right, though. It's fascinating, isn't it? Energy is such a colossal market. So, you know, our revenue now, look, we're a 4.5-year-old business in market. Our revenue is £2 billion, only $2.5 billion. And yet our global market share is what, probably about 0.2, 0.4%. You know, we've got an incredible amount of work to do to make any kind of difference at all.
Right, but if you look at the UK, your sort of home, your home and pioneering market, 3.5 million homes. What are they? There are 23 million homes. So, you know, that's not bad. That's 15-odd% doing the maths, you know, probably wrongly, but on the fly. That's pretty good for the. And so, talk to me about that platform. What does Kraken do? Why is it driving so much growth, or is it Kraken that's driving it?
Yeah, I think it's really important that it is. So we didn't start out as an energy retailer that built a technology platform. We started out to build a technology platform. And in order to be able to test our hypotheses about how energy could work, we needed to build an energy retailer to test the platform in market. So Octopus Energy is a retail business, although it, you know, is incredibly important and you know, is the driving mission for the vast majority of our team. Part of its job is really to prove the way for what we think technology can do to drive the energy transformation, to drive costs down and help consumers benefit from green energy rather than seeing it as a problem.
And so there's a couple of things there. There's pushing the costs down, and you also talked about green energy. So what you're saying, I mean, is the green incidental or is the green core? Let's start there.
Yeah. That's a really good point, right? So the green's core, but you know, if you look at Kraken today, it's a bit like an iceberg. The bit that's visible is it is a better engine for running an energy company. You know, it's great for customer experience, customer service, efficiency, you know, driving down the cost of operation. It does everything from sort of, you know, managing the telephony and digital contact with customers right through to helping, you know, power loads of machine learning for forecasting, all that sort of thing. But actually, deep under the HUD, what it's designed to do is make the transition to renewables a positive economically, financially, in energy. What I mean by that is renewables behave different than fossil fuels. We all know that. You know, with fossil fuels, national grid or whatever the equivalent in any country is, in the vernacular, can wake up every morning, there's a sort of fairly predictable demand curve, and they'll just turn on and off, you know, fossil fuel stations to meet that need. In a renewable world, you have to invert the way you think. You know, National Grid wake up in the morning, they look at the weather forecast, and then you have to turn demand on and off to meet those needs. Now, the traditional energy system finds that a really difficult idea. But actually, you know, if you're really at the core of how you build relationships with customers, including the deep technology for it, then you can really start to match time of consumption to time of generation. It is a great fortune that at exactly the same time as we're building more and more renewable generation, we're changing how we consume energy. So for example, an electric vehicle, you know, typically here in the UK, an electric vehicle might hold the best part of a week's worth of electricity for a typical house. So you've got this big discretionary load, even before we get into things like vehicle to grid. What we need to do is be matching the time we're charging that car with the time we've got renewable generation. Once we're doing that, by the way, we can monetize renewable generation better, which means that it can get cheaper, we can attract more investment to it. That then paves the way to sort of a decarbonized heating using the same technologies for matching consumption and demand. We can really move to a renewable system cheaper with that kind of tech, those kind of consumer relationships. And I think for a long time, energy companies, utilities, you know, networks, grids, governments, we're all debating. But the only way of really finding out what you can do is just getting out there and doing it, finding out what works with customers. It's how we found that, you know, a smartphone with a touch screen was better than the old, you know, kind of mobile phones. It was only when someone built one that consumers adopted that we discovered that was the way of the future. And it changed society. So, and I think we can now do the same with energy.
Now, and one of the things that you have done, presumably, you couldn't have done it without Kraken, without this platform, using the traditional software that everybody else has got. One of the things you did was you launched the Agile Tariff, which is the UK's first time of use tariff, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, Agile was the whole point, really, was to say, look, we as an energy company see dramatic changes in the cost of electrons throughout the day, day to day, you know, month to month. And yet, typically, consumers are passed a flat cost. Now, if we look at other, you know, kind of consumer markets where prices vary, I don't know, tomatoes or strawberries, when you get an abundant crop, prices are low. When, you know, the crops are less abundant, prices are high. And that enables efficient markets to clear. And I think with less waste, you know, and with better value overall for consumers. Well, we need to do the same in energy. And I think, yeah, the Agile Tariff, the idea was, you know, we essentially have a formula which we publish that connects the half hourly price of electricity to the price consumers are paying in that half hour. We then really critically, actually, we published alongside that a bunch of APIs. Now, consumers don't need to know about the APIs. APIs are there to enable companies, people that make electric vehicle chargers, you know, companies that make heating systems, whatever, to automatically read these price signals and then optimize on behalf of the consumer. So many of the consumers will literally just get home, plug an electric car in. They don't need to think about the price of electricity. It will just optimize based on this tech. I think the other bit is, of course, consumers can choose to optimize manually on top of that. So there's a really, the UK has got a simple heuristic. Electricity is expensive between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. It's also expensive when it's not windy. Now, that just means that basically, if you get home from work and you cook, you know, dinner for your kids, stick the dishwasher on at 7:30 in the evening, it'll be a lot cheaper than sticking on at 6:30. You don't need to check the price. It's just going to happen. So I think it's really interesting for me that by publishing, creating that product, we were able to see how consumers responded. And it's been, I think it's really heralded a way to making renewables beneficial for consumers, rather than the world we were stumbling into of, you know, people seeing renewables as being a cause of high taxes and so on.
How hard was it, or how easy was it, to pass on that price signal to consumers? Because this is not something that everybody's doing, and it's not something, there's been, you know, quite a lot of nervousness about that, because it does mean that at certain times the price will be high and everybody starts, you know, squeaking about energy poverty and goodness knows what. So this is, the regulators are not, haven't been pushing you to do this, have they?
No, it's quite interesting. I mean, our first dynamic tariff, we're actually a daily tracker. The idea of that was that customers never need to think about energy bills again. Like, you know, essentially, if you know that you're always following the market, it's a bit like with the stock market, you know, instead of actively trading, you can just have a tracker product. So we kind of tried that. But a journalist said to us, what about when prices spike? And we showed, you know, the data said, like, it's just not a big issue in the grand scheme of things. But she said, look, but people worry about that. So what we did with Agile is, based upon that feedback, that question, we put a cap in. So the price will never exceed about 35 pence a kilowatt hour. We've modeled it so we can take the risk on those rare spiky occasions. And the rest of the time, underneath that, the consumer's got full dynamism, including, by the way, the price is going negative. So what we've got, you've got, is got, and again, it's the kind of thing you can only do when you're iterating in market. But I think we've built a mechanism that really helps consumers kind of use energy in ways which are sympathetic to the system. At least if they do use it in ways which are sympathetic to renewables, then they'll get, you know, very cheap electricity. But it still protects them from the worst. And we could have spent months debating that, but we actually spent 4 days building it. And now the world can see how it works.
And it's great. You know, if you go on Twitter, you'll see, you must have seen this a lot more than me. You will see people saying, yes, I made £1.20 charging my car last weekend or whatever it was. So there's definitely that sort of the gamer types that really, really enjoy that. But how much difference does that Agile Tariff make in terms of actually moving electricity demand around? Because for that, you need not just the gamers, you need, I was going to say normal people like me, but that might be pushing it slightly.
Yeah, so I think let's separate dynamic pricing within the energy system from the way in which the consumer experiences the pricing. So Agile tariff is one of, I think, 27 different tariffs we have that use price signals to change the way in which people use electricity. By the way, it's not like you go online and have to choose one of the 27, right? We make all that very, very easy for people. But so with Agile, we saw a 70% reduction in peak usage at peak times, massive change. And most of those people are not the gamers. Most of those people are just plugging an electric vehicle or indeed a heating system, and it's doing it automatically with no thinking. On top of that, some of them just have that simple model in mind, which is, you know, just try not to use your washing machine dishwasher between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. or your tumble dryer, right? Use them outside of that. You don't have to do esoteric 3 a.m, right? Just avoid the peak. I think, but outside of that, we also have things like, you know, electric vehicle tariffs that have got fixed slots. So midnight 30 to 4:30 a.m., for example, is very cheap. Or ones where you can choose your cheap slot. You know, you can choose a slot that's 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. The shorter the slot you choose, the cheaper it is. So using all those, what we found is we can really use just price signals to move consumption around, to flatten the curve at a very granular level. And you know, what we'd really hope is that over a period of time, you'd be able to take a substation network, a street, and as people are electrifying transport and heating, we can flatten the curve and get dramatically more out of the network as it stands. There are two big benefits to this, I think, Michael. The first one is that obviously it reduces the need for additional infrastructure to get more out of your existing stuff. We make it last longer. We can electrify and decarbonize cheaper that way. I think the second one is that, unlike many other times in energy, one person optimizing in their own self-interest, you know, using the cheap slot, using the cheap electricity, is actually pushing the price down for everybody else as well, because they're reducing the competition for electrons when they're scarce. So we're keeping the infrastructure cost down, which is good for everyone, and we're making better use of electrons when they're available. And I think that kind of behavior, that kind of economic model means that even when you've got relatively few people in the gaming category and then quite a few people in the optimized category and some other people in the time of use category, they're all contributing to a cheaper system for everyone.
Now, we are electrifying transportation. I think that's already clear. That's kind of, you know, the thundering herd is going off towards EV. We are about to thunder. The herd is about to start thundering towards heat pumps, or at least Boris has said, you know, the Prime Minister has said, we're going to have 600,000 installations a year. That's a lot of electricity. Does the benefit of what you're doing, are there diminishing returns or are there accelerating returns?
I think there are accelerating returns. It's a great question, right? So essentially today, you know, look, energy in the UK, and in fact, even in most, in fact, all of the competitive markets, it looks like Gosplan, you know, the sort of the Soviet era central planning system, where we may allow a tiny little bit of kind of entrepreneurial competition right at the edge with this kind of consumer. But governments are still planning how much of each kind of generation they're going to have to meet needs. They're still kind of planning these kind of monopoly grids and monopoly charging systems. And the problem with that is, just like it was in 1980 that Mikhail Gorbachev visited London and asked Margaret Thatcher who did the central planning, because the Soviet Union's best trained economists were doing it and they had queues at the bread shops. He saw no queues in London. And she said it's price signals. Now, you know, without price signals, what you end up with is, you know, milk lakes and butter mountains and at the same time shortages or massively overspec'd inefficient systems. So, you know, what we're talking about is finding ways to harness price signals throughout the system so that investment is attracted to the right places. The product of that investment is monetized optimally, and consumers, users are exposed to price signals. Participants in companies such as ourselves are able to invest where it's going to be most effective. So what that means in simple terms is, let's take products like Agile, right? Today in the UK, on a windy day, we literally pay wind farms to turn off their generation, right? Because the vast majority of the UK electricity system isn't exposed to a price signal that says right now electricity is very, very cheap, right? So we just turn off the generation. This is bonkers, right? Because at other times, we still turn on coal power stations sometimes, right? Tons of gas at other times because there's not enough wind. Now, if we can use price signals to mean that, you know, every green electron that we generate can be used by someone, can be put to use, then first of all, we will more efficiently price those electrons. That will attract investment to the right places. Secondly, we'll enable technologies that shift consumption, that make the most of those electrons, to work based on the basis of, for example, cheap electrons during times of high generation. So, you know, what we don't need is governments choosing how much battery storage we're going to have here. And I mean, I say governments could be grids, but it's all monopolistic, right? As an energy company, we should be saying, first of all, can we get our consumers to use electricity when it's abundant and when the system is empty? And if we can't, then, you know, for example, what we might try and do is we'll say, right, you know, we'll build some batteries at the end of the street that will soak up electrons when they're abundant, and they'll be available for our customers when they're not. And then you can scale that all the way back to generation. If we follow those price signals, then I think we can attract more investment into generation because more electrons will be monetized. We can drive down the cost of electricity because we're using them rather than throwing them away. As we drive it down, electric vehicles get cheaper to run, and electric heating becomes ever more realistic. So I guess for me, you know, there is a huge compounding benefit in working like this. It's like data. Do you remember when you're, I mean, you and I are probably similar ages, Michael. I think you're a bit younger and certainly more handsome, but your mobile phone, you used to have to delete text messages because there wasn't enough memory to store them. And now you record every moment of video of your kids' lives, and you'll probably never even watch them. And they replicate it 25 times on your computer and in the cloud and everywhere else. You know, that abundance of data, it's not like, you know, kind of the world of data storage providers and cloud platform providers and so on have kind of all gone bust because the cost is dropping every year. We found utility for it. And I think energy is like that. You know, we've got this opportunity to relentlessly every year drive down the cost of electricity now and to do it with zero carbon. And it will create whole new industries just the way that the ubiquity of data and computing power have done. I've got examples, by the way, if you want.
Well, so it's music to my ears. You know, I let you go on there because this is exactly, you know, I wasn't campaigning, but I was trying to persuade people that price signals matter, that we needed to move to reverse auctions to get cheap renewables. Here's a little known fact. I actually worked on Perestroika. I was in the Soviet Union in 1990. I like to say working for the Ministry of Aviation and Special Constructions. It wasn't quite as simple as that. And you're right. I was meeting Soviets all the time who were convinced that I was lying to them because I said that at a building site, you would just go and, you know, if you needed bricks, you would just kind of send out a fax to a bunch of builders, merchants, and get the best offer, and the bricks would arrive. And they're like, no, that's somewhere in the system. So I hear you completely. I hear you on that. Give us one or two examples of that because you wanted to, and then I want to ask a question which is more difficult.
Yeah, great. So look, an example for me is I discovered that we kind of got this series of customers doing vertical farming. Now, you know, vertical farming turns out to be farms that are inside warehouse buildings or whatever in towns and cities. And in theory, it sounds very nice. You know, they grow the crops locally, so you don't have food miles. It's a sealed environment. So 99% of the water that goes in the building leaves in the fruit and veg. There's no need for pesticides. It's a sealed environment. The biggest single cost is energy. And in fact, I was talking to one and 55% of their costs were their energy bill, electricity. Using something like Agile, what they've been able to do is the crops now sleep at the times that electricity is expensive, right? Because it's a sealed environment. So the diurnal cycle, they can just optimize it based around, you know, some combo of what is cheap and what's best for the crops. As a result of this, they're now able to be cost competitive with crops that have been grown, certainly crops that have been grown in other countries and then air freighted in, increasingly cost competitive with things that have been shipped and trucked. And so I think the interesting thing for me is a bit like no one spotted when the iPhone was launched that would be the end of the kind of $1 million cab medallion in New York, because it would pave the way for Uber. Similarly, with renewables, no one's spotting the incredible number of industries it's going to transform or spawn when we have these endless green electrons.
Okay, but let me ask you the difficult question. The UK is fairly far north. We don't have equatorial sun every day. In fact, the ratio of solar output from the solar on my roof in W2 is 14 in summer to 1 in winter. There's no solar in the winter. So you're talking wind, and the wind can disappear for a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks. And you're not going to solve that with batteries, and you're not going to solve that by waking up all your, salad greens in those vertical farms and saying, right, actually not waking them up. In fact, if there's no wind, you'd sort of put them to sleep for 2 or 3 weeks and hope to wake them up at the end. But that's not going to happen. So how do we deal with these long wind lulls, particularly when we've electrified heating? Because those lulls could happen, just at a moment when the temperatures plummet.
Yeah, so look, I mean, first of all, we don't, the whole idea that we have to solve this problem centrally is kind of wrong, right? It's muddle-headed, right? Price signals solve problems. Now, you might say, in principle, we have to be able to solve it because otherwise we can't go this way. That's cool, right? But I don't have to give you the answer. Just like, loads of things to which the iPhone or the smartphone is the answer.
I'll push you on that, because you would have to give the minister the answer, because, yes, we don't want to have central planning. Exactly, Michael. Yes, we believe in price signals. But if the lights go out, or if there's no heating in the old homes and they die of hypothermia, then
it means
centrally.
Yeah, sorry, Michael. Let's be really clear. We'll get onto that in a second.
Okay.
The problem is easy to solve. The point really being, though, that it is hilarious that we don't sit here discussing how we're going to meet our potato needs when there's been a harsh frost in spring, right? I grew up in the 1970s and 80s, and I remember these centrally planned conversations about what was going on with the Ministry of Production and British Leyland, right? Sorry, to the non-British audience. The point being that markets can solve problems brilliantly. So when I give you answers right now, which I will do, they will almost certainly be far from optimal, because the market will cream anything any of us think of, right? And it will do it faster and cheaper than anyone else. Just like people didn't solve the electric vehicle problem through central planning. In fact, 2 or 3 years ago, the experts were still saying, batteries weren't going to be the answer, and lithium ion had all these production problems, and you couldn't get enough precious metals. It just turns out it's all nonsense, right? Once you've let market forces do their work, we're discovering alternatives to precious metals, we're discovering new deposits, we're finding new forms of battery technology.
Greg, there are some people in the Ministry of Hydrogen who would disagree with you.
I mean, one great problem with centralized planning is once someone is an expert in the hammer, every problem looks like a nail. But the next thing then is that, and the great thing about competition is that, companies have got investment in loads of different technology, are all going to compete, and some will win. Now, to answer your question about the UK and kind of heating and wind and so on. First of all, this kind of capacity myth, right? I've heard people saying, if we're going to build enough wind capacity to handle winter heating, we'll talk about the lulls in a second, but there's going to be a lot of excess capacity. It's like, fantastic. That means for a lot of the year, we're going to have endless green electrons that are near enough free, right? That's pretty amazing, because what it enables us to do is loads of great things that we can't currently do with cheap green electricity, guilt-free, carbon-free electrons. Now, once we're enjoying living, so much of the year very cheaply, actually we can afford as a nation, in the UK's case here, to have more expensive solutions to handle things like the lulls over winter, right? So for example, do we handle the lulls by, first of all, you've got wind farms all the way around the UK. And my understanding is that, if you had the entirety of the circle of the, in our case, the UK's island peppered, then you're down to, typically the worst case is 4 or 5 days of lull. Now it might be longer than that very occasionally. We'll get onto that in a second. But once you've got that kind of capacity, you're then able to say things like, are we using our spare capacity to generate hydrogen, right? And we store it, right? And although it's expensive to generate hydrogen, it would be bonkers to use it for domestic heating, for example. To use it for intraday storage, for multi-day storage, even for potentially longer than that, it's a great idea, And that's one way in which we can plug it. But, you know, once you've got price signals operating, do we find that, enterprising companies decide that running, you know, a new undersea cable to Iceland is going to help kind of provide cheap electricity during those times? Do we tap geothermal sources in other countries or dig deeper geothermal here? They're all possible, but you need price signals to reveal what is the optimal solution. So the point really, Vin, to your question, your opening question, the physics mean that we can easily answer the question about what do we do about, for example, electrified heating, even on windless days. But the economics will reveal themselves far more efficiently if we have price signals.
Okay, now, so I accept all of that. You're preaching to the converted. I do think that there will be, it's legitimate for ministers to worry about that bit when, you know, you and I would say, well, that isn't going to be a problem for probably 15 years, really, to get to that amount of renewables, 10 years, certainly. But
the thing is, if we do it iteratively, Michael, we can stop at any point and pause. Right, so let's iterate our way there.
Yes.
And if we're finding it a bit difficult, we pause for a while and we say, you know, we'll keep some of those gas plants running just while we kind of get better solutions. But we can do this iteratively. We don't have to solve it all in a big bang. And it's, you know, my gran today, she's 96 years old and she's living in a sheltered accommodation, essentially not seeing anyone other than her carers day in, day out because of COVID. And she's staying in touch with the world because of a $50 Android tablet. 10 years ago, or just before the iPhone launched, I think 2007, so 13 years ago, if you said to people, how are you going to solve that problem? They would never have come up with that solution. It happened because we got the technology into the market. Competition drove the price down dramatically, and we opened up solutions no one had thought of.
Well, in fact, the French government came up with a solution called Minitel that problem, and they were going great guns until, of course, the private enterprise and the price signals all worked, and all of that stuff got ripped out and junked. A couple of times you've referred to yourself as an energy company. Are you conflating energy and electricity, or would you ever see yourself getting into the molecule business, that whether it's gas or hydrogen or anything else?
Yeah. So it's, first of all, we sell £1 billion, $1.3 billion of gas per year as it stands. And that's going up a lot. Okay. I just don't want to be selling gas. All right. You know, I want to be moving away from stuff that causes climate change. So our job is to meet energy needs of customers just with, you know, lower prices and less CO2 every year. Now, we've looked at alternatives. We looked at, should we be like, you know, fully backing the idea of hydrogen for heating, for example? I just think when we look at it, if the mission is to drive energy costs down whilst going renewable, whilst tackling climate change, the answer looks more like electrification. That'll be the cheapest way of doing it.
Right. Now, I think we've established that you've built this platform because it enables the customer and obviously the energy company to kind of play these markets and to be very flexible. It sounds like it could be very expensive. It sounds like the sort of thing that a conventional utility would go crazy trying to build is it expensive, and how do you control costs?
You mean on the platform itself?
The platform itself, yes.
Yeah.
What are your transaction? How do you keep those transaction costs low?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like we didn't come from an energy background. We came from a technology one. And I shudder. I'm terrified at the thought that energy companies are going to go out and try and build technology. The history of companies in non-tech sectors building good technology is not great. Just like energy companies kind of talk about how special energy is, I think tech companies will talk about how difficult tech is. And I think tech is difficult because at the very core of it is architecture. Now, if you've got a board made up of finance people and maybe people who understand operations, there's no one in there that really knows whether the tech that you're building is going to scale, whether it's well architected, whether it's secure, whether it's, you know, whether you should delay a project because actually it's going to get the architecture right, or whether you should keep the pressure up because actually, you know, entropy means that projects will always expand to fill the maximum time you give them. So I think one of the things for me is, and this doesn't just apply in energy, it's around the world, boards need to learn about tech.
I will just interrupt you. I'll let you go in a second, but just on exactly that point, when I joined the board of Transport for London, I asked them how much they were spending on writing code or on their IT as a whole. They'd never thought about the question. All the board members and the senior members of management, the executive committee, not one of them had written more than, 100 lines of code back at school. Yeah. And I had written probably a few thousand, but that was it. I was like the most tech savvy person. And it turned out that we were spending somewhere of the order of £1 billion a year through TfL and its various contractors, which they never thought about. There's all these people beavering away, writing code on behalf of TfL with no oversight whatsoever from the senior levels. So we tried to change that, but it was hard. It was hard. That was not their culture.
No, it's not. It's not easy, right? And I think let's just explore that a bit, because that we live in a world in which technology is the driving force for change, whether it be kind of the obvious stuff like social media or the stuff around the corner like machine learning, and you've got people who are buying this that don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And so what you'll typically have is a board who will appoint senior executives to manage tech. But if you look at what most of them are doing, they're not defining, they're not architecting, they're procuring. Right. So then you've got a load of people whose job it is to actually kind of integrate different sets of procured tech. You've got all these best in class solutions being squidged together by contracting firms who've literally got misaligned interests, because they'll make more money the longer the projects go on, the more they go wrong and need fixing. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying any of them are acting kind of with malintent there. It's just all the incentives are misaligned. Now, can you imagine running your finance function like that? We expect people that are running companies to have, really good knowledge of finance, not just be able to read a P&L, but to be able to think about discount rates and, the impact of different costs of capital and all these kind of questions. And they're expected to do that themselves. And yet when it comes to, is our code any good? Yeah. They will typically ask a senior person in their tech function, who will get a less senior person, who will get a third party, who, by the way, will then get another third party. And eventually it comes at the line and it says, they say it's good or they say it's not good. And you can't check for yourself. You'd never do that with your finance.
Yeah. I heard you give a statistic on the cost of administration. You talked about how many sort of SKUs, stock keeping units, the average energy company has, and you compared with Amazon. Can you run through that here?
Yeah. Well, it's just one of the observations we made when we were starting the business. So the numbers might be slightly out of date, but Amazon at the time had 330 million different products, right? Which, by the way, it has to get to you by some combination of planes and ships and trains and automobiles and people knocking on your door when you might not be in. It's got to take payment in whatever way you want to pay right there and then, by contrast, certainly in the UK, most energy companies have got two products, gas and electricity. They've got a meter in your house and a pipe and a wire to deliver it. They've got a direct debit, typically, and a government-sanctioned estimate for what you're going to use every day. And yet somehow, Amazon's cost of administration was around 2% of revenue. And in the UK, for energy companies, it was nearer 14%. And you've got to say, that kind of spoke to the opportunity for tech, right? And that was just tech to smooth up your operations. Never mind the dramatic improvement you can create for customer experience, customer service, and then, paving the way to that much more dynamic, renewable future we talked about earlier.
Now, you've done some interesting, that's a fabulous statistic, the sort of 14% for two products and 2% for 350 million or whatever the number was. You've done some really interesting things about how you organize the company to deliver service. There's some wetware as well as software, some humans that you've organized as well, correct?
Yeah, so look, I think it was quite interesting. When we employed about 20 people in customer operations, our operations team, it's not a call center. The person you speak to does every bit of solving a problem themselves. So there's not a front office, back office, or any of, and there's not lots of vertical specialties. you know, it's a more fulfilling job. I think it was the sociologist Weber who talked about alienation. You know, like Adam Smith's pen factory may be inefficient, but it kind of alienated people from the product they were making. Whereas a medieval gargoyle kind of craftsman conceived of and made the whole gargoyle. And so, you know, that kind of ownership we tried to give to our customer operations team. But when seeing the job through end to end, but when we were growing, we found that somewhere between 20 people and 50 people in the customer operations team, people started to lose that sense of ownership. They wouldn't answer the phone as fast because they thought somebody else might do it. They kind of had a sense that maybe they'd done more than their fair share, so it's someone else's turn. And so what we did was we were like, how do we reinvent what we were when we were a tiny business? And we broke our customer operations into teams. Each team is about 10 people. Each team of 10 people look after, I don't know, about 70 or 80,000 customers. And they do everything for those 70 or 80,000 customers. Each team is completely self-managing. So we don't have a sort of central planning function. And they'll tackle different problems differently. They'll organize their days differently. They'll organize their priorities differently. But the statistics for the performance of every single team and every single individual are all published. You know, they're all available on our data system. So everyone can see how everyone else is performing. And if someone's trying something that's kind of doing better than they're doing, well, they can adopt it. Now, this isn't some sort of hippie free-for-all because, you know, first of all, every single member of the team is, they're a shareholder. So they all want it to work. Secondly, because everything's published, you know, kind of, you're continually discovering what's better, and there's no excuse for not improving. And I think finally, there's the real reward for success, which is teams that are doing well grow, and then they split and form two teams, creating new leadership opportunities for everyone. The interesting thing for me was that as a manager, is every time something's not working, you have a desire to micromanage, to sort it out. And we have to learn not to do that because otherwise the teams won't sort it out for themselves. Secondly, as a manager, you have a desire to standardize. You know, people say to me, but what do you do if one team's not performing? And it's like, well, you know, the whole point here is for some teams to do better than average, some have got to do worse. And we have to accept that because otherwise we wouldn't get the constant improvement. So as a manager, you can look at that going, literally, I know that team could do a better job. But if we intervene too much too soon, we lose the magic of the system. Wow. And it's a really interesting way of building this highly scalable business that, by the way, has grown 50% during the pandemic.
Yeah, no, it's great because you've created a learning system. And I think that, you know, as I look around, I love to find these examples of how learning, you know, small, nimble, competitive, also cooperative, and learning beats massive, centralized, standardized. And there are political lessons that I don't think we'll go into, at least maybe not until we meet in person for next time we go for a beer in London. But I hear you on letting the teams, not micromanaging. One thing I used to do was if we had a problem, I'd invite everybody who ought to be solving the problem to a meeting and then not show up.
Brilliant. I love that.
You know, it's such a simple thing. It's like they all know what they're at the meeting for. They all know what the problem is. They know the problem better than I do. Why do they need me?
That's brilliant.
It works. It works. I want you to talk about the role of machine learning. You talked about it in a very blasé way just earlier. You said, oh, you know, we use it for sort of forecasting call volumes and blah, 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 blah. But that is, you know, embedding machine learning is also one of the secrets of how you've kept the costs down, is it not?
It is, yeah. I mean, look, first of all, to really get the most out of machine learning, you need to have a lot of data that is essentially all in one place. Now, of course, you can kind of simulate all in one place by scooping it up or putting a meta layer over it. But the more it's really all in one place, the easier it is to deploy a wide range of things so that the machine learning kind of algorithms, the bots, can look at as many inputs as possible very efficiently. And then we have everything from, you know, one of my favorites is the workforce planning. So a company of our size, we now employ, I don't know, maybe 500 people in customer operations in the UK. And maybe a bit less than that, but that kind of magnitude. Now, typically, we might have, I don't know, 10 or 15 people working in workforce planning to kind of schedule all, to work out how many phone calls we're going to get and how many emails and, you know, kind of what work can be done by each team. And we have zero people doing that. There's just a machine learning algorithm that is continually looking at, you know, how many calls are coming in, how many emails are coming in. And it's also looking at how long they're lasting. And then it's able to look at things like, you know, how many bills we've sent out, how many meter reading requests we've sent out, how many people are kind of receiving a price change notice or whatever it will be. And it takes all of that data and then it generates a forecast. And it generates a forecast for each team. So very granular, 10 people in a team. It creates a forecast for every 15 minutes through the day of how many people need to be available, for example, to answer the phones. And the team leader can tell it, look, today I want an average time of 2 minutes. And it would create a forecast for kind of the staff requirement. Or you flip it around and say, today I've got like 7 people available because there's a couple off ill and 1 in training. And it will tell you what the average wait time will be by 15 minute segment. And you can move people around as required or say, hey, look, I know you're on training, but it'd be great to delay that or whatever it will be. So that machine learning is basically, it's quite funny. I sometimes think like, you know, the big fear of AI is we're all going to be working for robots. And in a way, we're beginning to experiment with that here, and it's working okay so far. Similarly, every single phone call is transcribed live. Now, today, we'll have had about 20,000 interactions with customers by phone and email. So every single phone call is transcribed live. Every email, every text-based interaction is already in text format. The machine learning algorithms then read the conversation, and they work out what it was about. They work out the extent to which we've resolved it. And we have live data, literally live on screens when we're all in the office, of what is going on in the business in terms of what the topics are, what the problems are, what do we need to do to resolve them. So now the interesting thing there is, of course, as a management team, we're not going to go micromanage with it. But that might tell us that it's time that we improve the software that reads smart meters, or you know, the teams need more training on some topics. Or, you know, when the teams come and talk to us about a problem with payment adequacy, we kind of understand what's going on. And the teams themselves can look at that and say, why is our team getting loads of payment adequacy and the other ones aren't? Hey, is it something to work? But all of that is not based on the kind of subjective, one of the team have chosen something in a dropdown, which, like, let's face it, when you get a dropdown saying what's this about, you always end up giving up in the end, right? It's too tedious.
You usually go down to the bottom and you look for other.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? I do that myself when I'm helping customers. And you know, the reality now is you don't have to worry about it because the machine's doing it. We forecast every smart meter we've got at the half hourly level for months ahead, right? Every night, these machine learning algorithms are calculating a forecast for the consumption at the half hourly level, as far out as we can go. And they put confidence intervals on that based on the weather and all these clever things. Now, all of that then gives us, like, with no human intervention, tremendous amounts of efficiency in the business that improve service but drive costs down. To answer your question earlier about cost, you know, we now sit on 150 billion rows of data. It's going up by 2 billion rows a week. It's all being worked on by machines as well as humans. And yet, you know, our we were benchmarked against a sort of an incumbent rival. Our data center costs are 20 times lower than theirs.
Okay, so I think we've reached the point where we kind of get a picture of what you're doing, and it is revolutionary. There's no question. Global domination, you know, you talked about you've got 0.4% market share globally. What's the right market share? What's the target? You said 100 million by 2027, but even that, 100 million households, that's going to be out of what, a couple of billion? So, I mean, it's still only a couple, so it's still only 2%. Is that the right number?
I mean, this really does tell you what's wrong with energy, doesn't it? If you look at things like, you know, e-commerce or even transport through something like Uber, you know, what we've seen is that global platforms have been able to transform the way in which those sectors operate. Because what you're learning in one market at scale, you can transfer to other markets at scale instantly through global platforms. And I think, you know, in energy, we have to go that way. Today, even the biggest global energy companies typically have a completely different stack. And I don't just mean software stack. I mean a business stack. Everything is different from one country to another. Yeah. Now, that's holding back the fight against climate change. You know, we can create a cheaper, greener transformation if the world is able to kind of solve this problem across all the geographies roughly at the same time. So I guess, you know, it is pathetically underambitious for us to think about 100 million customers on a single platform. And yet, you know, as a startup, You know, it was embarrassing to say we're going to get a million. You know, now we're looking at 17 million licensed. By the way, 18 months ago, that figure would have been less than a million. So don't get me wrong, I think the exponentials point in the right direction. It's just scary to think about where it leads.
Well, is it scary, or do you just need to, you know, you're the CEO, so you'd have to be the first person to do it. You've come up with this word, electech. Was it electech?
Electricity? Well, yeah. Is it green tech, clean tech, electech, enertech? I mean, who knows, right? We need a word.
Green tech. I got kind of burnt, you know, using those terms. Like, we all did, and I'm not sure what they mean, but the idea. But what I was going to say is that you, as CEO, surely have to be the first person to start imagining the billion household, you know, energy platform, because you know the same thing would have been said about the billion user media company or the billion, you know, and then you got Facebook and then you got Amazon. I don't know how many users they've got, but I'm sure it's in the billions. And certainly it's billions are not scary numbers in other sectors, and if that's what you're doing, you know, lean in and say yes, we will have a billion accounts.
Yeah, look, I think one of the biggest challenges we've got in this is the government and regulatory systems that mean that, you know, instead of having a global internet for energy, every country has a different national grid. I mean, I don't mean the company, I mean, it's sort of, you know, grid and network system, differently regulated in every way. So it's not just the way you present it to consumers that's different. It's the way you charge for access. It's that they're all trying to solve the problems by putting batteries wherever they think they need them or whatever it be. And I think, when we started our company, people said, how are you going to tackle the big six? You know, the big six were the six big incumbents in the UK. Some countries, by the way, have got a big one, right? Others are nationalized.
Italy, looking at you.
So there's certainly some in Europe, and, you know, at least Europe's got some degree of competition. Yeah. But then, you know, behind the big six were really big companies, like, you know, the oil companies, big oil. But actually behind the big oil companies, you know, even bigger than them is big tech. You know, like, you know, what is it? I guess just by way of example, I know Shell or BP, what's their market cap? Probably around $100 million.
No, it's more, it's still more than that, although it's been going down quite considerably. So it's $200 or $300 billion.
So when we started the company, people said, how are you going to tackle the big six? So they look like big companies, but, you know, they were just big by UK standards. You know, if you were lining them all up, you know, bigger than the big six were big oil. And I think if you look at big oil, you're typically, you know, Shell, BP, places like that. Market caps of about $100 billion of some unit, dollars or pounds. But behind them are big tech, where you've got, you know, companies now heading towards trillions. One of the problems is this kind of view that countries have of what scale is, where, you know, if we're going to tackle something on the scale of climate change, we've got to go beyond national level solutions. And that really does mean that countries have got to work out how do they open up, not to, you know, we've got this kind of terrible thing at the moment where a country, a government will often define a solution and then put it out to tender. So you're having a different solution tendered in each nation. Now, what the private sector does best is actually create solutions through innovation. And we need to open up markets to that.
Is this not just telecoms prior to the telecoms restructuring? This is British Telecom or whatever, 1980, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, 1980 was a long time ago, right?
Not innovative. Driven by sort of some misplaced sense of national security or industrial planning, or worry about what happens if the system fails and trying to micromanage it. Is this not exactly the same?
Yeah, and let's look, I mean, you use telecom as the example. Well, here in the UK, you're talking about 1980, that was 40 years ago. And today, you know, two of my team members have both complained today about 4-hour waiting times to speak to a telecoms company. One of them is coming to the office because it's going to be 2 weeks before a telecoms company is going to come and fix her internet, right? So telecoms is still broken. Now, you know, that's bad enough. I'm in central London, and my mobile phone doesn't work in half the building I'm in, right? I mean, this is just unacceptable. Now, you know, if we can live with telecoms like that, how are we going to live with an approach to climate change that's so badly implemented? Now, don't get me wrong, if we're not careful, that is exactly like that. The tackling, the fight against climate change is going to be analogous. But if we let, if we find ways to let companies use grids like the internet, where we will find ways to use the infrastructure that governments have put in place to get more out of it on behalf of their citizens than anyone could imagine, then we can have a much cheaper, faster green revolution. But right. If instead each country is defining its own solution, you know, it's going to cost a fortune and take forever.
So final question or final topic, you have broken through to, you know, your sort of nearly 2 million UK households, 3.5 million that are using the platform, or 2 million under the Ops brand, 3.5 million on the platform. You've got 15 million around the globe. You've got this vast growth rate. Prime Minister and the Chancellor know you. Not only have they know you exist, they've been to visit. So you're right at the center of things. Are you optimistic? You know, we've got the UK, you know, hosting COP26 in Glasgow at the end of this year. Everybody is focused on green finance. Are the planets aligning, and are you optimistic, or is it a sort of a blip, and then, like the telecoms example, in 40 years we could still have the same nonsense going on because there wasn't enough faith in the sort of solutions that you're proposing?
I am optimistic, right? Fortunately, economics is aligning with the environmental need. You know, renewable generation is getting cheaper every year. Electric vehicles are getting cheaper every year. I mean, I was looking on Alibaba, and you could buy a 5-seat sedan with 250-mile range for $15,000. So the fundamentals are going the direction we need. Now, whether we will, as societies, optimize and get this as cheap and as fast as possible, you know, it's still debatable, but at least the economics means that we will reduce our climate impact dramatically. I think the pandemic in particular has crystallized governments' views that change can happen faster than they ever realized. You know, the way in which supply chains adapted to lockdowns, the way in which, you know, companies adapted to remote working. I think, you know, someone at Microsoft said, you know, 6 years of change happened in 6 weeks in many countries. Well, now let's capitalize on the fact we've learned we can do that in one sector, and let's do it in the fight against climate change. I think COP26 is kind of, I think it's the first since, you know, the sort of Paris commitments are meant to have been implemented, right? We've begun our plans. So it's huge from that perspective. I think for the UK, it's the opportunity to double down really on being a country that's been doing well in their move to renewables. But the real race now is who can do them faster, bigger, cheaper. And to use your telecoms example earlier, you know, it must have been 10, 15 years ago that we started hearing, you know, here in the UK about, you know, internet speeds in Korea. The fact that in Poland you could get, you know, a same day broadband connection, in the UK we had to wait weeks and weeks if we were lucky. So, you know, there's still an enormous amount to be done to get nations competing on how fast and how cheap they can do this. But I think we are seeing a doubling down of political commitment. You know, the change of administration in the United States as well is really going to contribute to that. And then in countries, increasingly, you know, we're seeing politicians competing on who can do a better job of tackling climate change. It's been thrilling to see that here in the UK. So, you know, economics, politics, and proof of disruptive capability might just be aligning.
Greg, was there also part of the disruption that you just looked at the competitive landscape and said that customers are being poorly served by the customer, poorly served by the regulator?
I think one of the biggest issues is that we've got a sector that doesn't understand customers, consumers. People repeatedly tell me customers won't do that, consumers won't do this. And it absolutely reminds me of so many other sectors. You know, we talked about mobile phones, in which people thought customers wouldn't want a touchscreen phone with the internet. And I think far too often we've got policy that is being led by that kind of thinking. And it suits incumbents to suggest that, you know, you can't engage consumers, or that, you know, we need to solve everything treating them as a sort of dumb off-taker rather than a participant. So I think with Octopus, part of the reason for building a very consumer-centric brand is really to prove that, you know, when consumers join us, they are more likely to kind of embrace new ways of using energy and to think more about kind of the cost and the climate cost of it.
Very good. Well, Greg, you seem to be saying to the politicians, stay out of our business, but give us the infrastructure, particularly the data infrastructure, and we will finish the job. So on that note, I think we'll leave it there. But thank you very, very much for joining us this evening on Cleaning Up.
Thank you, Michael. It's been tremendous fun. And, you know, I'm on beer number two. So if you had three or four, who knows what we might say.
There'll be time for that. Lovely to see you.
You too.
So that was Greg Jackson, CEO and founder of Octopus Energy, building the energy utility for the climate change generation, offering green and affordable power to 100 million and maybe beyond that, a billion households. My guest next week is Amber Rudd. She was a Conservative MP, minister under Theresa May and also under Boris Johnson, Secretary of State for Energy and Climate from 2015 to 2016, during which time she championed the UK's move entirely off coal by 2025 and also led the country's negotiations through to the Paris Agreement. Please join me at this time next week for a conversation with Amber Rudd.